Welcome to the Design of AI podcast. We dive into how AI products are designed and how they're changing the world around us. Please subscribe on Spotify, YouTube, or Apple.
Generative AI has the potential to be the most transformational technology ever. It could help individuals achieve superpowers and enable businesses to attain new levels of productivity. But what were the models trained on? Today, we'll be exploring Gen AI's copyright problem and what it means to the product teams building the next generation of tools. Today, we're speaking with Virginie Berger, a seasoned professional in music and tech industries. She's renowned for her expertise in music business innovation and integrating AI in music strategy and rights management. Her impressive 20-year career includes pivotal roles at Downtown Music SongTrust, Armonia, MySpace, and Microsoft, where she played a key role in generating revenue, forging strategic alliances, and championing artists' rights. She now extends her expertise as the Chief Business Development and Rights Officer at MatchTune, where they're pioneering advanced audio fingerprinting technology based on AI algorithms to detect all types of copyright infringement, AI-driven audio modifications, voice cloning, and AI deepfakes.
This conversation is going to be about music and creative works, but why it's important to any product team is the idea of derivative works and original works. We're moving in a future where it's going to be hard to differentiate what's real, what's a copy, and what's a copy of a copy of a copy with all kinds of biases introduced. Will consumers and users need to know the original source? Will they need to know what kind of bias or perspective your product is influencing? Will they need direct line of sight on where things came from? Will they need proof about the ethical training on things? It's hard to know right now, but music is the first battleground of what that future of AI products is going to look like.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us. This is such a hot topic now. Every day that I go on a music publication or any tech journal, the question comes up, copyright, copyright. I have a reference from an article from yesterday. Anthropic CEO Daniel Armodi was asked about a lawsuit, and he had a very interesting quote. It's really much more like the process of how a human learns from experiences. And so our position that is sufficiently transformative, and I think the law will back this up, that is fair use. It's a very interesting perspective.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you're a musician or someone in any creative industry, it's rather troubling, isn't it?
He said that he's quite sure that data training will be, you know, like fair use. It's not exactly the same thing. You can't compare AI that is not, I mean, are not creative, absolutely not, with human brain. And how an artist or songwriter or musician will work and will create. So yes, it's also based on, you know, training for sure. It's based on education for sure. But AI won't create anything new because actually it takes creation to recreate something based on, you know, prior creation. It's more and more frustrating every day, you know, when you read quotes like that, because they don't really understand music, they don't really understand copyright, or they don't want to understand, or, you know, they want to make money on it. But the comparison between creators, songwriters, musicians, and data is quite strange. Actually, fair use, it's, you know, it's about quote, comment, knowledge, education, or research. And when you have a trial, when you have a lawsuit, the judge will also look at the potential damages.
Can you explain how ownership and payouts work for music on digital streaming platforms and when used in TV commercials? So there's already a legal framework for how payouts should happen. How do they work?
Yeah, absolutely. So first, when we talk about streaming platforms, so it's what we call DSP, digital streaming platform. So, you know, it's Spotify, it's Apple Music, it's YouTube, it's all those digital platforms. It's really a negotiation of the percentage of revenue shared with streaming platform. It's really a pool. It's going to be divided by, you know, fractions of streams and distributed according to the total streams. And then it's going to be divided between publishers, between rights organization, between record company, and at the end, really, the musician and the songwriter will take just, you know, a very, very low, will make a very, very low income from streaming platforms. So we know for Spotify that Spotify pays between $0.003 and $0.0005 per stream.
question, just so we have wider perspective here. If I'm a photographer and I upload something, let's say, to Getty Images, how does the payout structure work there?
It's really based on the agreement. So for the US, if I take the example of music, so for the US, for example, it's not what we call free market, which means that the streaming rate will be based on the CRB, Copyright Royalty Board, and they will decide what will be, you know, a fair rate, if we can talk about fair rate when it's 0.00 something. Outside of the US, it's free market, so it's based on the market share. For a photograph, it's only based on, one, the market, or two, your agreement.
So in that case, you pay for the use for a specific period of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, last month, OpenAI's CTO, Mira Murati, sat down with the Wall Street Journal to talk about Sora. So their text-to-video generation product has really been impressing people. But she was asked point blank if Sora was trained on YouTube videos. And she said, I'm not actually sure about that. Before just shutting down that conversation.
Yeah.
Were you shocked or disappointed about that? Were you expecting that kind of response?
I think we were all shocked because the video was quite viral on social media and Twitter. Yeah, it's a bit surprising that the CTO of OpenAI doesn't know where, you know, they train their AI, their data. It was a bit surprising. So maybe she knows and she doesn't want to talk about. So the journalist was very pushy and, you know, asked question about YouTube. She said that they train and they use all publicly available video, which is not correct because it's not because it's publicly available that you can use it for, you know, data training or for commercial use, which is a case for OpenAI because at the end, they are going to sell Sora or OpenAI. I mean, ChatGPT is not free, so I pay for ChatGPT, for instance. So it means that there is a commercial use of their data. Following the discussion with the CTO of OpenAI, the CEO of YouTube said that based on their terms of service, TOS, no, they can't use a YouTube video to train Sora and to train their tools. So it just shows at the end that there is a lack of transparency also around, you know, data training, that we are not able to understand exactly what they are doing with their data and how they train data. So we know that they have a partnership and they pay, they have a license with Shutterstock. So the question is, if they are able to pay Shutterstock, why don't they pay other companies?
Now, there's a lot of different legal cases trying to deal with this issue today in terms of copyright and generative AI. But is there any definitive proof that generative AI products have been illegally trained on copyrighted material?
Oh, plenty. Because the New York Times was able, you know, just to target some data training. We also know kind of with Suno, it's a new generative AI music tool platform. We can't say definitive because we have no judgment on it. You know, it's lawsuits for the moment. So we are waiting for what the judges will say at the end. But we have plenty of evidences about it. The question now is, you know, what will happen with a lawsuit? Will they decide, will the judges decide that it's going to be fair use or not? And from there, what will be the consequences? When I say what will be the consequences, I think that I'm not sure that fighting for, you know, blocking or getting money for data training is the right battle. For me, it's more now, it's too late. It's really like, how do you say, genie out of the bottle? It's correct in English? Genie, yeah. I'm not sure how, you know, we'll be able to stop it. So I would say that instead of fighting for data training, I mean, we must be sure that it's not considered as fair use, absolutely. But the question for me is more like tracking derivative works and making sure that we can monetize derivative works instead of trying to block data training, because it's like, you know, mouse and cat, because you have data everywhere on the internet. So how can you block them, and how can you make sure that they won't choose data that are, yes, publicly available according to them, absolutely. So the question is more about derivative works and making sure that there will be a licensing framework, or there will be, you know, something in place that will allow rights holder to get paid from the use of their works, because at the end it's going to be like fraction of a cent if, you know, we want them to pay for data training and, you know, licensing the catalogs. So the question is really about how can we make sure that rights holders will keep track of derivative works first, and also will be able to opt in or opt out? Because we are going to have the same issues like we are in the US. There's no moral rights, but in Europe and everywhere in the world except in the US, there are moral rights, which mean that, you know, rights holder can decide if they don't want their music to be used for politics. I mean, everything, commercials.
So right now, a lot of these legal battles that we're starting to see are really around this idea of fair use and still trying to make that copyright infringement, you know, case similar to things like Napster, or, you know, in 2015 with Google when it came to the literary world.
I know that the music industry, you know, talks a lot about Napster, but for me, it has nothing to do with Napster. Napster, it was copy and distribution. That's it. Napster, it was 17, 18 years old guys who just wanted to share music. AI, it's smartest minds of their generation, backed by billions behind them, supported by governments. Because at the end, you know, when you are, I'm sure that when governments, because music is nothing, or creation, creativity, creative industries, it's nothing in the AI battle, which means that if the US government, or, you know, if the European Commission has to choose between fighting against Chinese AI or Russian AI, or protecting music, they won't choose music.
Well, maybe let's ask a different question then, right? So we're really, you know, we're entering this era of generative music, generative film, generative literature. Do you think that, you know, given that there are much bigger implications of AI in the grander scheme of things, that consumers are going to notice or care if a work is original or derivative? Like, do you think that that behavior will shift?
It's really the question. Let's take, for example, what's happening now between Universal Music and TikTok. So Universal Music decided to pull out from TikTok their catalogs because of market share. And because, you know, they said that TikTok doesn't pay enough, which is true. And so they would like to negotiate with TikTok based on the market share. And it's, you know, actually, it's our rights organization negotiate outside of the US with DSPs, with, you know, music platform. It's fully based on the market share. Fair. But if you think of the number of new works that will be generated by AI, and it means that the market share and the catalog of Universal Music will be diluted, which means that because when you will have millions of kind of copy Universal Music artists, the value of the catalog will be diluted. So regarding your question about, you know, if consumers will care or not, I'm old, Gen X, and, you know, I had like that connection with the artist and connection with, because I knew the name and I listened to the album and I know the music. Now young people, they discover music on TikTok or Instagram. It's very, very short. Most of the time, you don't even know the name of the artist. So I'm not sure that they have this connection with, you know, the song or the artist. But for sure, it's going to be more and more difficult for, you know, an average consumer, someone who just listens to music on TikTok or Instagram, for example, to really see the difference between original and derivative works. So that how could they value authenticity, for example, or, you know, how could they value human-created content when they won't know if it's original works or if it's just derivative works?
Do you have any insights as to whether people at Spotify, you know, New York Times or Getty are fearful that their business models are going to become completely devalued? And from this perspective, let's take somebody like a Suno, right? They could become a streaming platform that is totally generative music. What's the future?
So yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with you. It's like, why going on Spotify when on Suno you can listen to whatever you want and you can create whatever you want? And you can also create songs that are very, very close to originals, original works. So I read this article about on Suno about, you know, Eminem and Rolling Stones that sound exactly like Eminem or the Rolling Stones. But Spotify are, you know, is already using AI for music recommendations, for instance, and also for new artist tools like playlist and playlisting. So they are already using AI, but not like Suno. They are using AI on the B2B side, not on the B2C sides. About Getty, well, yes, because when AI now can create images or custom images, or, you know, also assist in faster image editing, it's in terms of business model. I can understand that, you know, it's a big threat for them and that they want to make sure that their data won't be used for data training, but also to create derivative works. Because what is absolutely crazy with derivative works is that you are competing against yourself. Because as, you know, let's take the example of a musician. So the Beatles, maybe Suno, you know, is using the Beatles catalog to train Suno. So at the end, someone will be able to create music that will sound like the Beatles. So actually, the original works Beatles will compete with the derivative works Beatles. And it's going to be the same thing with photographies, with music, with images, because at the end, the creator will have to compete against itself, themselves, because it will create exactly the same work. We know that for the New York Times, the reason also behind the lawsuit is that they fear that people won't use Google to find, you know, articles and to look for news, which means that they will lose part of their ad revenue sharing with Google, which is a huge part of their revenues at the end, because people will go through directly with, you know, OpenAI and get info, maybe not news, but info from OpenAI instead of, you know, looking at Google and maybe, you know, getting a search link with New York Times, and so, you know, getting info from the New York Times. So they will also lose revenues. And we know that it's also part of the lawsuits behind. It's the potential lack of revenues at the end.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said earlier. You brought up the term, the genie's already out of the bottle. How can creatives move forward equitably if the genie is out of the bottle, if the data has already been scraped? Is there a path that you prefer? Is there a path that the industry prefers?
I won't talk about, you know, on the behalf of the industry, because I know that, you know, there are a lot of opportunities, but it's unfortunately, it's not unified. It's not a unified front. So I hope that soon we'll know what the industry wants to do and how they want to move forward. But based on myself and what I would like to do, well, we have some solutions. So we talked about, you know, original works versus derivative works. And maybe here we have a path with making sure that all companies like Suno, OpenAI, Udio, you know, the last one, they will add an ID to each piece of derivative works, which is absolutely possible because we do it in the music industry. You know, each recording has what we call ISRC, or, you know, for publishing works, it's ISWC, which means that we are able to track works everywhere and be able to pay the rights holder. So we are doing it in the music industry. So it's just maybe forcing or negotiating or working with AI platforms to make sure that each time a work is created, they will have like a code that will allow us to track and to know that it's a derivative works. And so maybe to pay behind and to create a licensing framework. You know, Andreessen Horowitz, the CEO of, you know, the investment fund, said that maybe it's going to be easier to track original works because there are going to be, you know, so many derivative works that it's going to be easier maybe just to track and put a code to original works, which is, well, we'll see. But so we have this solution. Also, maybe to work now on a licensing framework about derivative works. We can't ask the user, the consumer to pay. So yeah, we have some solution. We also have to make sure that rights holder can opt in or opt out. We also have to work on the transparency and for, you know, AI company to disclose their data training. It's what Adam Schiff, representative, wants to do with the AI bill. When I say Jenny's out of the ball, it's also a question of being too late. Because as we are waiting, you know, for something to happen, it's at some point, so I'm not sure that we'll be able to negotiate with those platforms. It's also a question of power. I'm also afraid of, you know, the delay, that maybe it's going to be too late.
I want to thank you so much for coming and speaking to us about this very complex topic. And hopefully artists can find a way to get paid and that creativity expands and doesn't implode, as might be one of the options. Thank you so much for your time.
What an interesting and complicated conversation. So let's dig a little bit deeper and see, what does this actually mean for people who are building product? If we were to take it from the standpoint of, you know, starting with how are these large language models being trained and what are they being trained on? So if you take something like ChatGPT-4, it's been trained on trillions of different words and combinations of those words. And, you know, if you look at someone like OpenAI in particular, they've come out and said explicitly that it is nearly impossible to train these large language models in a way that is effective without the use of training them on copyrighted materials. So much as to even say, you know, copyright content is pivotal for training because the LLM's performance on a wide range of linguistic tasks benefits significantly from using these copyrighted materials.
So if we try to simplify that down, one of the big differences between Google and these LLM models is Google's job is to scour the internet, find relevant piece of information, and organize them for you. It's not there. Google was never designed to give you answers. It was to help point you in places where you can make a decision where those answers are. These LLMs are like looking at a Google search result, except where you have a person who's gone through the 100 top results to try to summarize it for you and have an opinion or point of view. So imagine these LLMs have been trained by digesting everything that your Google search would have found, every video, every Q&A from Quora, everything that was on Wikipedia. That's what makes them so powerful, but also what makes them so dangerous, because they have to inform themselves on a point of view based on a huge amount of information.
One of the things that is particularly problematic when you think about not just these LLMs, but now as you start to utilize more of the tools that are being built on top of these LLMs, and Virginie kind of touched on this as well, is understanding the terms of service. Because oftentimes, once you've agreed or bought into those terms of service for those tools, you are sometimes giving up your rights, or you are signing away your rights to whatever, you know, you're training it on or what's being produced and created through the use of that tool.
An example of that was Suno. So Suno is a new, really hypey AI music tool. But what's fascinating in the terms of service, and Brittany discovered this, is that basically anything you create in it they train itself on it. So imagine that you're writing an essay with a tool, but every time you're writing that essay, it's learning from you. Or if your Google Mail, your Gmail was learning based off of what you wrote to somebody. There's some dangerous components to that, because imagine if you're training Google to know exactly who you are and it can connect it to personal identifying information, you're basically handing over your personal rights to that system. Obviously, that is a darker perspective, but nonetheless, that's what these terms of service are intended to guide.
You're creating an output from this tool that you're using, and you actually maybe don't own the rights to the output that you've created. So if you're creating a song, you can only license or use that song for the period of time that you have a subscription to this tool. So you effectively are bought in on like a lifelong relationship with this. But if we think also more broadly, like I remember one of the very first really publicly used examples of AI was when people started like AI-ifying their photos and creating these like, but you're effectively licensing your likeness to these AIs and training them on your likeness and handing that away without people really thinking or considering about what that means.
An analogy of this battle is Amazon. Amazon has been constantly referred to as predatory because they will monitor what sells, which products sell heavily in the marketplace, and then create generic versions of that. It's very predatory, but unfortunately, that's what happens when you go into a closed ecosystem like that. Now imagine a New York Times clone that could spit out almost identical content without having to pay the staff. That's the concern. These terms of service, and obviously the advocacy groups of product users are there to protect you for that. Legally, a lot of policymakers are trying to have protections put in place, and the future looks optimistic, to be fair. It looks like there is a concern for this, and that the future likely will have more guardrails for this. Nonetheless, we're, you know, on the razor's edge right now, where it's hard to know who the good or bad players are looking into this future.
It's particularly interesting because if you look at, you know, the two sides of the coin, you have, for example, OpenAI, who are at the heart of so many of these lawsuits because they've been training their LLMs using copyrighted and personal and private information. But at the same time, they're starting to roll out features like a history where you can go through and you can actually pick and choose what it will remember, you know, the length of history that you want it to remember, things like that. So they're trying to make some adjustments, but, you know, is it too little too late? Who knows? And on the flip side of that, you have Google, who are currently at the heart of a class action lawsuit saying that not only were they training their data on, you know, maybe copyright information, but that they've been basically scraping all of this data that they have about users.
Now, when we think about what we can do about this, one of the suggestions that was brought up in the interview we just finished up was this idea of tracking attributes. From one end on, in terms of music, there's like metadata that assigns who owns the rights to it, so you can always track it. On the other end, let's say when you upload music or videos onto YouTube, it's constantly analyzing it, often using machine learning tools to figure out if there's some copyright infringing components there. Those are some of the ways to do that. The risk here is because of the giant, massive wealth information that these LLMs are trained on, that it's potentially too late to go back and start tagging what's real or what's not. We start getting into these discussions of, well, is this what, you know, crypto services are intended for? And you start getting these questions of whether processing power are powerful enough to actually handle that level of additional meta information. Hard to know right now. The implication in many respects is kind of tragic. If we pump out more content, can someone determine the difference between real or derivative or fake? Hard to know right now. We don't have the technology to analyze that or process it. And the human ear it's gonna be inseparable. But let's look forward. Let's look at what product teams can do about this. And at the core of it is that most product teams today are leveraging APIs from LLMs where you're not sure what it's training on and where the terms of service are often changing quite a bit. From a product user standpoint, you need to be careful and be aware of those terms of service. You need to be concerned and conscious that some products are learning through your use. And quite honestly, almost every product is doing this today. Maybe that's fine. Maybe that's just telemetry of the future. It's hard to know. But nonetheless, we need to know if confidential information is excluded, whether if something you upload that was confidential goes into the main bulk of training data. And you just generally need to be aware of the latest developments on those products that you're using today.
Yeah. So there was actually a study that was done about a month ago about transparency and data leakage on LLMs that found that it actually is quite easy to spot copyrighted texts, confidential data, things like that, if you know how to ask it into the LLMs.
If we look at product teams and the lessons for them, it likely is going to become a bigger and bigger issue to be extremely transparent about the data use. Right now, people are caught up in the hype of using these products. They want the advantages of them. But once this becomes a saturated marketplace, and once there's a little more policy measures in place, it's likely going to be important to be extremely transparent on how that data will or will not be used. There's also a risk with any new AI product that there are going to be impacts, unintended consequences within those industries. I'm sure the developers and the founders of Suno have all the best intentions. I'm sure that they actually do want to democratize the use of music tools. I'm excited to use these products. I think there's something that's going to help creativity. It's going to help us get in touch with music. But we can be so focused on the grand benefit that we forget that for the ultimate creator, it undermines the value of what they've done. And sometimes it can take away their livelihood.
You know, I think that transparency of data use, I think that's really important to people. I think it's going to become increasingly important to users, especially as the EU AI laws come into effect in the next 1-2 years. So recently, a new LLM came out called Clem, where they have been the first LLM that's been certified to be entirely ethically trained when it comes to not using any copyrighted or confidential information. They are, I'm guessing, going to be one of the, you know, the first in many who will start to come forward and want to be more transparent about the type of training data that they have. The other option when it comes to looking to be really closed and, you know, more ethical or more clean in the training data that you have available to you is to look at having a proprietary or closed ecosystem on top of those other LLMs.
The future likely is going to be guided by policymakers. There are mandates coming out or being drafted right now that prescribe that what your training data is has to be publicly available or transparent. As a result of it, you might see competitors come online to OpenAI and Anthropic and such. And you might also see, as Brandy was mentioning, some proprietary layers that come on top of those or proprietary in-house models getting developed. Let's be realistic. The majority of product managers don't need access or don't care if your model's been trained on literary works or music or film or any of that. For most of us, we just need a tool that can process customer service, requests, that can analyze, you know, weather patterns if you're in some like incident response tool. These other LLM training issues are more from a cultural perspective. They're ones that aid in the comprehension of things. And as Virginia mentioned, the genie might be out of the bottle at this point. It might be unaddressable, the issues related to it. But nonetheless, for most organizations, particularly ones in regulated industries, you're going to start looking at more closed ecosystem models, ones that you can train, ones where you can be certain that confidential information is withheld, protected, or maintained in specific servers. That likely will be the future of this. And for the rest of us, the consumer application will be run through an OpenAI or Google. It's not that much different than what the way it is right now, where Meta and Google control a lot of information. And we just have to have confidence that it's not going to be used unethically.
I think one of the other considerations is also about looking at these smaller language models. So rather than relying so heavily on LLMs, is looking at uniquely trained, very narrow focused language models.
Another way to look at this is from the perspective of model experts. What this means is that for most businesses, you only need a tool that's an expert in one thing. As a result, it doesn't need to be trained on much of anything. It needs to have a very closed set of inputs and a very specific type of output. Think about an intercom or something like that, where there's a customer support portal. There's customer support questions that come in. There might be contacts from your website. And maybe there's like the emails going through. If your terms of service enable that, and that's a clean end-to-end transparent interaction, it can be trained on all that. And one agent can be explicitly focused on customer service requests. Another one can be focused on sales requests. Another one can be focused on maintenance issues and such. It's almost trying to replicate, and we saw this with the Devin tool, a Copilot tool that came out for coding recently, that really a lot of these tools, while built on LLMs, they're trying to be hyper-focused on specific tasks and trying to replicate how a human would do that, what their role would be, what their guiding principles would be, what the ethical standards of that person should or shouldn't be. And there was like a leaked framework that came out for OpenAI, and it took this perspective as well, where basically even their data set is being processed through this model of experts, where each section is trying to answer specific components of that question from different perspectives. And then they need to go through a filtering process and align on what the response should or shouldn't be. We saw this problem come out with the Google LLM, where it was, you know, too woke was what the news headlines were. But in that, it likely was an imbalance across that framework. And you brought up Anthropic. Now, Anthropic was broken off from other AI groups largely because they wanted to make a more ethical business. Now, that was the topic of the day a couple of years ago. And as a result of it, we had an entirely new competitive product that's now getting funded from Google and Amazon that's come out competing with OpenAI. So when the public makes a topic very important, when it gets headlines, businesses respond. And it would not be surprising if one of the main groups, whether that's Meta in the case of Llama or Anthropic, apply this as a core differentiator in their business model. So we'll see.
Yeah, and I really hope that that's true. I think cloud is such a great example of this because they came out originally as a differentiator with their constitutional AI. And since then, I think there's been more public pressure to have more of a constitutional or an unbiased approach to other LLMs as well. And so, you know, I really do think that if we as the public decide that it's really important to us that there is higher ethical standards, then there might be some pressure that gets put on. We're also starting to see this, though, with these bigger LLMs where they are creating more niche versions. So Google just came out with Code Gemma and Recurrent Gemma, Recurrent Gemma being more research focused, but they're trying to create these LLM versions that are more of that model of experts as well.
Well, it was a wonderful conversation today. And while in 2024, GenAI has a copyright problem, I hope that a year from now, we can look back and say that there's been some sort of resolution to this, that there's some clarity, that businesses are setting a path forward, and that this was just a blip on the radar.
Thank you for listening to the Design of AI podcast. The show is hosted by Brittany Hobbs and Arpi Drake-Figueredo. Subscribe on Spotify, YouTube, or Apple to get our latest episodes. We speak to leaders at the forefront of AI to learn how great AI products are designed and how they're transforming industries. To contact us, visit our website, designof.ai.